Welcome to Report Out's Hidden Voices podcasts from around the globe. Report Out is a human rights research organisation and charity based in the UK. Report Out monitors, researches and documents the lived experiences of sexual and gender minority people and their communities in different nation states. We use this information to educate others on the lived experiences of sexual and gender minorities and to campaign and push for social change across the globe. You may notice that we use the term SOGSC, which means sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, and sex characteristics. Why do this? Because it's a culturally sensitive umbrella term to cover all sexual and gender minorities. These interviews will consist of SOGSC individuals who live in different nation states. And whilst we'll be discussing the barriers that they face, we will also highlight how they find resistance to them. Welcome to our Hidden Voices podcasts.
Hello, Arian. How are you today?
I'm good. It's been a long time since we last talked, so...
I know. Do you want to explain how... we both have met?
Yes. So I was taking my now ex girlfriend to the Jogja Museum, and they were having an LGBT exhibit for the arts in the Jogja Museum, and obviously me and my girlfriend were stoked to see these Indonesian artistic explanations of what it means to be a certain gender or what it means to be a certain sexuality as an Indonesian. And we met in one of these exhibitions about the Bugis people. So the Bugis people have five different genders, and I remember you were just sort of looking around and not really understanding what the people were saying on the screen. So I offered to translate and tell you what the what they were talking about, because I noticed that some of the captions weren't saying the exact same that they were talking about. And I told you that I've actually already seen this before, because I live in Jakarta and the guy who made this lives in Jakarta, and the guy who made this had a viewing at a coffee shop that I was at, and then we just traded Instagrams, I think.
Yes, we did. It was such a lovely, pleasant experience just bumping into you both. And I was really unaware. I didn't actually go there for that exhibition. I just went there just for the art in general, and seeing a queer exhibition there was such a lovely, pleasant surprise, and I was so thankful to bump into you so you could actually explain it a little bit better.
Honestly, I was quite shocked, because I planned that trip on the fly. So when we got there, we were oh my gosh, there's an art exhibition on sexuality here. We have to go. We can't not go.
Yeah. So for maybe a bit of context for the listeners, would you be able to explain a little bit about, you pronounce it better than me, the Bugis people?
The Bugis.
Bugis.
Yeah. So. B-U-G-I-S, Bugis. So I'm not a Bugis person, so I can't take authority on this, but
okay.
What I know from that little documentary that was made, the Bugis people have five genders, and it's there are the two normative genders. There are the two the female and the male, and then there's also the genders that are male but leaning to female. I think it was born male but in their head they are a female, and then there was the born female but in their head they are a male, and then there was the middle gender, and the middle gender is a totally like disconnected gender from like your birth. And I think there was something in the Bugis culture that was like, if you are like, the more like non-binary you are, the more like disconnected you are from your original gender, like your birth gender, the more like you are, the more you are standing on like the same level as a god. And like you were basically like the medium for God to speak through you, because I think it was something around the lines of like, because God has no gender, people with no gender are therefore like more more close to God. It was honestly one of, it was honestly one of the most like positive like renditions of like non-binary or like trans people in like a sort of culture, you know.
And this is an Indonesian this is an Indonesian culture, isn't it? So
yeah, this is Indonesia. Bugis, it's definitely not on Java.
Yeah.
Well, I know where it's not.
Well, this brings us into questions about Java. So for the purpose of the listener, you live in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, that is based in Java. Mm-hmm. And how long were you, because you describe yourself as American Indonesian, right? So mm-hmm. were you born in Jakarta?
I was born in Jakarta, and I spent like 5 years of my life here before eventually moving on to live in America for another 4 years of my life, and then I came back here and I've lived the rest of my life here. So whenever people tell me like, you know, Indonesians can be a little bit racist, and they can kind of ask me stuff like when are you going back home to your like motherland, and whenever they say motherland they always mean America. But I've only spent 4 years there, and basically Jakarta is like, this is where I was born, this is my home. And
yeah, it's your home.
Yeah, I could never think of like living permanently anywhere else but here. As terrible as it gets, you know, there's been a lot of talk recently, especially because there's been like new talk about a new set of laws that were going to be pushed forward. There were a few riots that happened around last month and around this month as well. And there's been a lot of talk of like, I don't want to have my Indonesian passport anymore. Let me marry like some Australian guy and I'll just get over it, you know. I'll just become an Australian. You know what? Screw it. I'll just live my life as a Taiwanese person. I saw a lot of these like, I saw a lot of this talk, and I could never see myself in that position. I could never see myself hating Indonesia so much that I would want to move. And like, I could definitely see myself having to move, like needing to move. Maybe I'm like persecuted here so much, but genuinely wanting to, I don't think I could ever do that.
Is the persecution that you've just touched upon, which we can definitely talk about a bit more in depth, but is this persecution related to your identity as a queer person?
I think it's, yeah, so like the way I present myself is definitely like more feminine,
okay.
And I think it's like easy for Indonesian people to see like a more feminine person and like not think much of it. But even in the moments where I don't present myself as feminine, like I might present myself more masculine or more like, you know, non-conforming to like general standards of what a woman is. I think they tend to let it pass because I'm white. Like they tend to let it pass because I pass as like totally white. So whenever like, let's say I'll go out with a gay flag stamped on like a sports bra and like shorts, and you know, that's definitely a taboo, like a big no-no for like fully Indonesian people. Like if they saw like a brown person walk out like that, they'd probably be quite angry seeing it. But because I pass as white, I think they tend to just, hey, look at that white person being gay. Like, look at them.
Wow.
they tend to like give it a pass. And I feel like that's a little bit of a some privilege that I get. It definitely isn't like 100% privilege because I still do get like, hey, look at the gay person. Like, I don't get the mocks and jeers like I think a fully blooded like Indonesian person would get. And I think most of the quote unquote persecution that I get is, I feel like it might be mostly from my family because like I've been like, what's the word? It's not gifted, but like I've been blessed enough to be born in Jakarta, like the capital city. And you know, like you tend to find like bigger gay communities in capital cities because those are the ones that are most like metropolitan, right? And with Jakarta especially, there's like quite a big gay what's the word?
Gay scene, like maybe?
Yeah, gay scene. Okay. And when I finally like came to myself, like I found these people and I was like, well, I found my tribe, you know, I don't need to like go anywhere else. Like I found my people. I feel like the schools that I went to were also like international schools, and there's quite a divide between international schools and national schools here. You know, in the national schools, they tend to be more conservative. So if I were to go to like national school, I don't think I would be so open and like free with myself as I am today.
Yeah. I'm really happy that you've touched upon the fact that you've been able to find like-minded friends and, as you said, found your tribe, because that's definitely something I wanted to talk to you about. I know that when we met, and I was also very curious as to being like, where can I find representation within Java? And you said, I know, I remember so vividly you saying, you're like, if there's a queer person in Java, I know them. I'm very happy the fact that you've been able to find your tribe. But if you don't mind me asking, how was that experience for you, both firstly coming out, whether it is to friends and family, but then how did you, after you came out or while you were coming out, how did you find these people? How did you find perhaps organizations or safe spaces within Jakarta?
Okay, so I have like two separate stories when it comes to like coming out, and then I have two separate stories when it comes to like quote unquote finding myself too. Because when I was like a lot younger, when I was living in America, obviously things were a lot more lax because it's America compared to like Indonesia. A lot of things are a lot more lax. And I remember like I had a friend that had like two moms, and she was really open about herself being a lesbian, and she was really open about like talking about like, yeah, no, I really have like crushes on these girls and I don't have crushes on boys, and that's normal because my moms do it too. And I remember thinking, that's crazy, you can do that?
What's your secret?
Yeah, I know, like that's impossible. I could never say that to my mom.
Yeah.
And I remember coming home to my mom and asking her that, and at the time she wasn't so religious, possibly because she was living in America too. And I remember her telling me like, yeah, sure, it is possible, but it's not right. And it got me thinking like, so like what is right and wrong when it comes to love, right? And I think like that's like the moment when I was a kid that I started like questioning myself. And then when we went back to Indonesia, things started changing, and she got a lot more, like my mom got a lot more religious, and I started having to follow her, and I started having to like being taught by her that certain things are wrong and certain things are right. And I was really repressed when we came back to Indonesia. I just remember like thinking as a, I don't know, like an 11-year-old or 12-year-old, I was obsessed with like cartoon girls and like anime girls.
Yeah. And it's how it comes out usually, doesn't it?
And it was like, yeah, but these are like cartoon girls, man. Like they're not real, so it's fine.
Yeah. You try and justify it.
Yeah, like I try to justify these like feelings and these like thoughts that I had. And you know, being religious, it really screws you up as like a queer kid, because it really changes the way that you think about yourself, and it changes the way that you think about your own like self-esteem. Because at that point I was thinking like, if I am gay, then I'm not worth like living. If I really am gay, then like I'm like a sin in the eyes of God. And you know, I'm sure there are like queer friendly like Muslims out there, and you know, religion is really just like a cherry pick, right? You do like choose what you want from it, and you leave out what you don't want from it. You can't like take everything from it.
Yeah.
And when it came to Islam, it was like I had to take everything, or I wasn't correct, you know.
Okay.
I wasn't like a right Muslim if I didn't take everything. So when it came to that, I had to like choose between these two identities. It was like this correct identity that made like this correct identity was Islam, which was something that I've been taught my entire life, but it made me feel like I was drowning. And then I had to pick between that or the like gay identity, which actually represented myself, but it made me feel like a sinner and like undesirable in the eyes of other people and in the eyes of God. So, you know, it was difficult to come to terms with that. And then like having to tell that to my friends, struggled with that so much, just thinking like stop being me, and they'd start thinking of me like as like a weirdo, and maybe my girlfriends would stop being friends with me because they think I'm like interested in them.
Yeah.
But surprisingly, all my friends took it amazingly.
Oh, amazing.
I was worried for nothing.
So what age were you when you first started to be a bit more open with your friends about how you were feeling?
The first person that I came out to was actually my sister. At the time, we were very close, so I thought about telling her first before, like, any of my other friends, just, like, a trial run, right?
Yeah.
I think I was 10, I was 12, and I told her, like, yeah, so I think I'm bisexual, and she started freaking out. She started, like, you know, that's a sin, right? You can't do that. You can't live like that. That's wrong. And I remember feeling so like broken up about that. And I was thinking like, well, I don't think I can tell anyone. If my sister, the person that's like, quote unquote, the closest to me, right, can't take it well, then how would anybody else take it well? One of my best friends when I was 12, I remembered that like the first day of school, she did this thing where it was really stupid, but she put like tape over her mouth and she said like, this is my day of like non-speech in order to like remember the LGBT people who have like died for their cause.
Oh, wow.
It was
That's
like,
quite a brave move, no?
Yes, but...
Do that at school?
I don't think she knew any LGBT people, and like, I think this was like one stunt in her string of like quote unquote wokeness. Like she really wanted to be like an activist, so she just took whatever and then she put it on, right?
Did that make you feel? Did you feel comfortable then coming out to that friend though?
Yeah, even though it kind of felt like a performance from her, did feel like, well, this is. At least I have one person that I can come out to, you know, and she might not take it terribly. And I came out to her and I remember her telling me like, that's cool. I mean, why did you come out to me earlier? I would have been totally okay with it from the start. All of our friends would be okay with it from the start. You know, we're all cool here. And I'm like, you're right. Why was I worrying? It's because we're an international school, so it, like, I don't know what it is about, like, Indonesia, but I tend to trust people who speak English more. Just because, like, when you speak English, you tend to have, like, access to more, like, information that's already posted out there about, like, the LGBT community and, like, the queer community. So in Indonesian, it's a lot harder to find, like, articles about queer people or, like, LGBT people in Indonesian because it's mostly blocked off. It's banned. You're not allowed to, like, post that stuff on the internet or, like, the government will forget it, you know? So, you know, in an international school, they all speak English and they're all quite, like, quote-unquote westernized. So they were all, like, used to, like, the idea of, like, gay singers and gay actors, and they're all used to, like, the concept, and now they just had to face it, and it was a smoother transition than I would have expected from, you know, someone who's not used to gay media or, like, gay representation outside, you know.
Sure. How would you, on that note, how would you sort of describe, for someone who is listening and doesn't really understand about how Indonesia is in regards to the laws or the policies and the general understanding and acceptance of Soji people, how would you, for example, describe Java as a whole and how,
like, Indonesia as a whole?
Java or Indonesia as a whole, because I know that Java, I think, especially seems quite an interesting place in regards to, with, as you said at the start, like, the differences with religion and so on. How would you describe Java or Indonesia as a whole and their acceptance of Soji people?
The thing about, like, I would divide Java into, like, two separate camps, honestly. Like, when it comes to Java specifically, big cities compared to, like, rural areas have a totally different, like, perspective when it comes to talking about gay people. In big cities, it's generally, like, accepted as long as you don't talk about it. Or if you do talk about it, you talk about it with people that you trust will, like, be okay with you, like, for example, like, family that you know will, like, love you regardless, or I don't know, like, friends that you know will accept you regardless. You don't talk about that kind of stuff with, like, coworkers. You shut up about it when it comes to, like, strangers in the street. It's not, as long as you don't talk about it, everything's fine. But if you talk about it, people will start giving you weird looks, and they'll start praying for you, they'll start making ritual circles, all that kind of stuff. But when it comes to, like, rural areas, there's a lot of code words, and, you know, it really feels like being in, like, rural Java specifically, it really feels like everything has to be repressed, and, like, every bit that you enjoy about yourself being this way is sinful, and, like, every time you enjoy yourself, you have to realize that it's sinful, you know. And I feel like a lot of rural Indonesians that I know that are queer, they ended up having to, like, run away to, like, the big city because they felt themselves hating themselves in like, rural Java. I had a friend from Sukabumi, which is, like, quite rural Java, and he told me that, like, all the boys in his like, Islamic boarding school, they were, like, all gay for the moment. But, like, the moment they got out of school, they were immediately, like, married off. They never thought about guys anymore. It was strange because you could tell that they are gay. They were just, they're, like, repressing themselves, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a lot of what it is for, like, rural Indonesia. It's either, like, a phase or, like, a sin that you'll get over once. Like, there's a word in Indonesian, and I've heard it a lot, especially within like repressed queers here. It's always like, you'll tobat soon enough. And tobat is like an Islamic term for returning back onto the path of God. So like, you're having your good fun right now, you're hanging out with other queer people, you're committing your sins, but soon enough you'll return back onto the path of God, and this is all a phase, you know.
Okay, so if just from your description, it kind of sounds like maybe for some people it feels like kind of like what you're saying at the start, that it's quite hard to be both feel that you are being both religious and queer.
Yeah, I don't think those are two things that mix really.
Yourself, where you are.
Yeah, no, in Indonesia, like I'm sure there are definitely people out there that like do mix their religion with their queerness, and there is actually this one really cool church. I forget the name, but there's a church in Jakarta that's highly accepting of queer people, and like they base their entire like motto upon it. They say that like queer people deserve a right in the family, and like God will like what's the word? Azab. I'm forgetting the English word for it. God will like torture you in hell if you were to ever like kick out a gay member of your family, because that is your family and you're supposed to take care of them. It was insane for me to hear, because like there aren't many Christians in Indonesia, so
yeah,
hearing that like the acceptance of gay people doesn't come from like a Muslim center, but instead from like a Christian center, it felt like a breath of fresh air, honestly. Because truthfully, there's not been any like acceptance of gay people from like any big any big masjids or any big like mosques. If there are any people that like connect their religion with their sexuality, with their like queer sexuality, it has to be like an individual. There's not any like sort of organizations, like Muslim organizations, that will like connect for you. You have to do it yourself. And I mean, I feel like that's why I tend to be quite scared when I first talk to like people with people that like people in Indonesia, at least, that openly say that they're very like devout Muslim or like a very devout Christian, because I know for sure, like 99%, they will probably either hate me or like pray for me. So I, you know, it's sort of become like a defense tactic.
Okay. Your comments on praying for you, I kind of want to touch upon that, because I've seen that's something that I've seen reoccurringly within kind of the past year. I feel like there's been a lot of Soji news about Indonesia, and so much seems to have happened, so much persecution in Java particularly. I mean, we could kind of take this moment to pay respects to Myra, the trans woman who the only word for it is really tortured.
Right.
For listeners who aren't aware, it was a trans woman who unfortunately got burned to death by, I think it was six men. But what I've seen throughout these stories is that praying for people, and maybe also conversion therapy as well, you could use that as a term, it seems to be for some people acceptable. How do you feel about that? Would you agree with that, that there's becoming an increasing acceptance of that, or
I think I would say that, like, there has definitely been an increase in, like, fear of queer people. And it's definitely has, like, a positive correlation to the rise of Islam as well in Indonesia. There's been a frightening, like, rise of right-wing Indonesian Muslims ever since, like, 1998. Honestly, it's been going on for like 22 years. If you go back to like pictures of like the 80s in Indonesia, in like Jakarta, nobody wears a hijab. Like, that's, it's not normal. It's people are all out, like, what's the word? They don't look Muslim, right? Like, being Islam is not something that you wear. It's something that you are. And, it's not really like a badge like it is now, because now a lot of people tend to see, like, if you wear a hijab, then you're immediately seen as like a good person. Like, people tend to say things like, she's wearing a hijab, therefore she must be doing something nice and she must be doing something good. And then they'll use that analogy to counteract like mean people with hijabs, and they'll say like, but she's wearing a hijab, like, why could she be mean? Like, that's unheard of. And that's especially with like men as well. If like a man, you know how in Islam, well, it's not really Islam, but it's like Southeast Muslims, they'll wear like hats on the back of their heads to show that when they go for prayer. It's called peci in Indonesian. And they'll say the same thing. Like, if he wears a peci, or he wears like Indonesian and Muslim attire, baju koko, it's like a white shirt that you button up all the way up to your neck. If he wears clothing like that, like, he's bound to be a good person. And if he's not a good person, that's something that you have to question. Like, why would he wear baju koko, and why would he wear a peci if he's not a good person? That's insane. That's unheard of. And it especially applies to like queer people, because if a queer person is wearing a hijab, then the immediate thought is that they're an imposter, and like they have to, you know, they're trying to like blend in with us, and they're a spy. I feel like that's why, yeah, I feel like that's why a lot of queer people have also found it difficult to connect their religion with their sexuality. It's because it's so difficult, you know, like you have to sort of like guard your heart before you get hurt. And you know, I used to think that it was possible to combine my religion with my sexuality, and it definitely is, but I've chosen the active choice to not do that, simply because it feels more like an act of rebellion to not do it than to do it. Because doing it, I feel like I feel like it would be more centrist, and I feel like it would be like these religious people and like Muslims in general, they would probably come up to me and say like, oh, but you're Muslim, like, you surely you know that like there's a better way for you than this, and they'll do that thing, they'll pray for you, right? Yeah. And meanwhile, if you straight up say that you're an atheist, or straight up say that like you're agnostic, they do no such thing. They make no such effort. So it's right. A little bit like I'm guarding my heart too. Even though I do think that there are like some honorable things to say about Islam, and there are definitely some good things about it. I mean, it's a part of my culture, you know? I grew up with this. It's not something that I can just like drop off at the door and just like say goodbye to. It's how I grew up. I've memorized some chapters of the Quran. I know. Did I ever tell you that I went to Islamic boarding school?
No, you did not. How was that?
Terrible.
Really?
It was like jail. In Indonesia? Basically. Yeah, in Indonesia. I spent some time there, and I remember making a friend there, like. You know, I couldn't make any friends because they all hated me because I wasn't religious enough for them. And I guess people do that. They make cliques between like the most religious people. And I ended up making a best friend there, and I came out to her, and her first reply to me was, "I can't be friends with you anymore because I'm scared that you'll pass on your virus to me. I'm scared that I'll become one of you." And I remember not having any friends after that. It was terrible.
Wow, so it was seen as, well, she said the word virus, so it was seen as a disease, basically, your queerness.
And she said, "It's embarrassing to be seen with you, because what if people think, things about us, and I don't want them to think that way about us." And
right.
A lot of religious teachings, at least a lot of religious teachings that I grew up with and, I went to school with and, my community, basically, a lot of religious teachings in Islam, it's based on shame. So if one person is shamed for being queer, then everybody will oust that person from society, and they'll have to live on their own. I spent 2 years not having any friends because I dared to speak my truth, really.
Yeah. And I can imagine, after going through that, finally finding, as you said at the start, finding your tribe, finding like-minded people must, you said yourself, you use the terms breath of fresh air. I understand how that could just be so, feel so welcome. Do you, or any of your friends that you've made who are queer, I'm interested to know that has anybody really suffered from any sort of hate crime if they are seen as visibly queer?
It's difficult because there are definitely hate crimes that have happened. One obvious one it's quite an old story about the whippings in Aceh. Did you ever read that?
I have. I'm unaware of that.
So in Aceh, they go by Sharia law, which is law 100% from the Quran and the Hadith from the Prophet Muhammad. And the Hadith is basically the New Testament. It's stories about it's stories about the Prophet Muhammad and things that he has said and things that his friends have said that are kind of considered law as well, alongside the Quran. And Sharia law is conducted only in Aceh. And because Sharia law is conducted in Aceh, these two men that were it's terrible, honestly. They broke down their door because they suspected that they were doing something illegal, and they found them having sex, and they took them as prisoner, basically, and they whipped them in front of an audience that was yelling, "Yeah, take that, you homos."
Wow.
I think I was 10 or something when I first heard it, and this was before I even came out to myself. So this was wow, it must be terrible to be gay. I cannot be gay. I'm going to get a hate crime committed against me if anything happens. And, I'd rather be depressed and safe rather than happy and unsafe. That was how I thought when I was 10 years old, and that's not how a 10-year-old should think.
To feel fair for being yourself.
Right. And but for me personally, and the friends that I hang out with, thankfully we all live in Jakarta, so it's quite hard to have an explicit hate crime committed against you. What I get a lot are microaggressions.
So
there's a ride share, you know this, there's a ride share called Gojek.
Yes.
Okay, so basically it's it's basically Uber but with motorcycles. And so I love to talk when I'm on Gojek. I really like to talk to people.
You and me both.
Yeah. So I always love to talk to these Gojeks, and sometimes I like to like play around with them too. They'll ask me stuff in Indonesian, and then I'll be like, "Oh, I'm sorry, sir, I don't speak any Indonesian."
And oh, wow.
Sometimes like force them to speak English with me. But other times, I'll like test the waters. If they seem cool enough, I'll like maybe like 3 minutes before I get to my stop, I'll just straight up tell them like, "Yeah, so me and my girlfriend did this," and then I'll just like gauge their reaction, right? And the last time I did it, the Gojek driver turned to me and said like, "Wait a second, girlfriend? Like your date is a girl? Or do you just mean like a friend that is a girl?" And I was like, no, like my girlfriend, like I'm a lesbian.
Yeah.
I'm actually not a lesbian, but
I wanted to
force him to be scared of me.
Wow, that's so brave of you, I feel. But you're a very expressive person, which is something that I love. I mean, yeah, how was it that you described your style? Something like disco?
Oh yeah, no, I'm definitely just like a disco ball in like personified. I am a walking eyesore. I look like Twister if Twister was a person.
It's fantastic.
But
it's okay. Your story.
I told that Gojek that I was a lesbian and I'm exclusively attracted to girls, and that's my girlfriend. And you know, I was just explaining stuff about my girlfriend, and then he turned to me and he said like, "Wait, but why? Why are you a lesbian though?" And I had never heard that reaction before. So I had to like step back and I had to be like, "Why? Why am I a lesbian? Does there have to be a why?"
Yeah.
"Because I'm attracted to women." And then he said, "But you can change it though, like it's a choice." And then I told him like, "Well, if it was a choice, like can you choose to be like attracted to men just for me, just for 1 second, you know, just be attracted to, I don't know, like who's your idol, Cristiano Ronaldo? Let's you know, you love him now." And he's like, "Well, I can't do that because I'm not gay." And then, "Well, I can't be attracted to men, sorry, because I'm not hetero." And I remember him saying like, "No, but there must be a way. Like, I'll pray for God. I'll pray to God for you. Like, Allah will find a way for you. And you know, this isn't the end. You just haven't found the right man yet. You know, like,
oh, wow.
There are so many better men out there than this lousy girlfriend that you have." And I was like, "Really? My girlfriend is 175 centimeters. Like, how tall are men in Indonesia?" I think I got really offended then. It's really easy to emasculate like horrible Indonesian men.
You just have to like testing the waters.
Yeah,
which
I just
is something that I find your strength and your boldness is something that I find very admirable about you, for sure. Kind of on that note, that really makes me want to ask sort of a next question about, from a very much more positive note, how do you feel the queer resilience being in Indonesia, or maybe specifically Jakarta? Is there a lot of resilience to this? To discriminatory attitudes, whether it's through protests or whether it's through just general people speaking out and coming together?
I feel like I've actually recently just had like a kind of like a spat with one of my oldest friends about this. She's a law major in Gajah Mada University, which is like a huge law university in Indonesia. And it kind of made her, It kind of made her see things in a bad light. What's that word? There's a word for that. It kind of made her like despondent when it came to like change in Indonesia. We recently had riots, and then I talked to her about those riots, and then she told me that, let's be real, Aryan, there's not going to be any change in Indonesia when it comes to, like, queer people because this and that and this and that. And those things that she mentioned was, like, we have so much support from Arabic countries and, like, Middle Eastern countries. So if we were ever to turn on Middle Eastern beliefs and, like, basically, like, take a whole 180 against Middle Eastern beliefs, we would not get any more, like, investment by Middle Eastern countries, which is, like, one of our biggest one of our biggest investments here in Indonesia, and it just wouldn't make sense. We will never have, like, a queer revolution in Indonesia because financially it doesn't make sense. And it was really disappointing and, like, kind of disparaging to hear that from, like, a heterosexual person. Like, from a straight person telling me that, it kind of felt like, so basically, recently in Indonesia, we've had a lot more, like, protests and had a lot more, like, movements when it comes to, like, women's rights, and especially with women's rights, but, like, to a lesser degree, queer rights. And LGBT people have been making, like, a steady crawl onto, like, Indonesian media and into, like, the Indonesian psyche.
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot more representation through big media outlets like the Jakarta Post, for example. There is the sharing of stories, which is always a great thing, no?
And the thing is that, like, LGBT people have always existed in Indonesia. And, like, people have always known that LGBT people existed in Indonesia, you know? Like, if you ask someone like my mom, who's very religious and quite conservative as well, she knows that these people exist. She just doesn't want to, like, she doesn't want to acknowledge them. That's the issue. And, like, it's a step forward from a lot of countries that don't even acknowledge that these people exist. And when it comes to, like, LGBT representation in Indonesia, although it is, it could be better, admittedly, it is rising. Like, there are more people active in, like, activism and showing up in, like, demonstrations and showing up for marches. And this is important, you know. Having younger people that have studied things when it comes to, like, sexuality, and have studied things that come to gender, and having, like, a younger generation more open to, like, all the information there ever is and ever will be on the internet, it really makes for, like, this new generation of more accepting and more, like, understanding and more queer younger people. And to me, I see this as, like, a total positive, and I definitely see, like, change happening in the future. And, you know, this is not a perspective that you can have if you are a straight person who's never seen that and has never, like, contributed to it and has never seen, like, has never, like, even considered to, like, search it up or even considered to, like, know anything about this. So me as a person who's, like, been out there and, like, been on the street demonstrating for, like, my rights, it's different hearing that from, like, a straight person telling me, no, it could never happen. How do you know? You don't, you know, you're not there, you don't march, you're not active. You don't know these things.
You sounds like you're really optimistic, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, what's the point in living if you don't have even a little bit of optimism, you know? And I feel like especially now, more than ever, Indonesia needs, like, its queer people to stay and its, like, young people to stay. Because, like I said, a lot of young people and a lot of queer people, they feel alienated by this country, and it's totally valid, you know? If I were in their position, I would definitely want to run away to, like, Canada too, you know? It makes sense, because you feel alienated in this country, and you feel like you might die in this country, and having having to fight by yourself and like not knowing that there's a whole tribe out there for you, it can make you feel like you just don't want to deal with it. And I've been there. I've definitely just wanted to run away to America once. Like, I don't want to deal with this Indonesian part of me that seems so backwards and seems so bigoted. I was totally, like, racist against myself at one point.
Really?
Yeah. It was like my sexuality had to deal with my race as well, and it had to deal with my class as well. Like, these are all things that are intertwined into my personal identity, you know? I can't just separate me being gay versus me being like middle upper class versus me being like a woman and versus me being Indonesian. These are all things that connect each other. And when it comes to like these young people going away, the only thing I can say is like, when you go away, who, like, then there really is no chance for Indonesia to survive or like to grow. Yeah. It really does take all the running that we can do to like stay in one place, you know? And if people keep leaving, we'll go back.
I absolutely love that. Like, you can hear the passion for your voice, which is it's just making me, you can't see right now, but it's making me smile so much. Is that something that if there was somebody listening who was from Indonesia and they may not have came out yet and they may just be coming to terms with some aspect of their queerness, would that be your message to them? What would you say to them?
There are people out there for you, and there are people out there that are willing to like support you, and there's a family out there for you. It might not be your own family, but there is a family out there, and I'm a part of it, so let me be your mom.
Amazing.
I'm so ready to tell like any queer person that's debating like leaving this country to 100% stay, because it's amazing being an Indonesian person, and it's not something that I would trade for the world, even with all its like downsides. Even though it makes my life terrible, even though it makes my life like difficult, even though I feel like Sisyphus pushing up the rock up a mountain and just keep feeling it like roll down, and then I have to start all over from the beginning again, it's still a reason for me to like live. It's a challenge for me to overcome. It's the hope that there will be an amazing future for me and for me and all these other queer Indonesian people. And it's not something that I can do alone, you know? So obviously these queer people, they definitely feel alone, and they definitely feel like underrepresented, but there are people out there, and you can't just give up on your country just because it's no good. Like, other countries are only where they are from the hard work and efforts of its young queer people too. Like, Stonewall didn't happen because of straight people.
Despite what some people want to think.
<Mm-mm>.
is it that hope that you have, and that optimism that you have when you see things that could potentially be coming into place, like for example the family resilience bill, and where, if correct me if I'm wrong, that is a law or a bill that could be coming into place, that's been debated coming into place, that will, as a result of it could affect LGBT plus people, and I think the term that I found is that it says that they are a threat to the family structure, so a sort of heteronormative family structure, and it encourages people to for example neighbors or members of their own family to report them.
Right. Yeah, I've definitely heard about this.
How do you... You're so hopeful and optimistic. How do you feel about that when you're facing that? our last question we'll be talking about this. So how do you feel about that?
I feel like that specific law and like laws that are similar to this, they cater to a very specific type of person. Okay. They cater to the there was a word for this. I believe it was like it basically acronymed to WIMP. It was like the Indonesian like fully blooded Indonesian Muslim man, the WIMP. Okay. And it really only does like westernized Indonesian Muslim pribumi means like indigenous like Javanese people or like indigenous Indonesian people,
right.
And these are the people that we should fear, these older Indonesian Muslim men who all want the same thing, money. they put out these laws in order to like take investment from like countries that are more conservative and like are more accepting of these kinds of laws put out into our country, because obviously, you know, why else would you put out a law like that unless you want support, unless you want like financial support for that law,
right?
And like there's been such a big opposition against it. If you haven't seen, the opposition for the omnibus law was incredible. It like in the midst of the COVID pandemic, like we've been having the worst like cases in comparison to the rest of like Southeast Asian countries. But we still put out, you know, we still went out, we still marched, we still. If you saw the entirety of Bundaran HI, like there's this major center, there's this major area in the center of the city. It's basically like elite Jakarta. The bus station was burnt down, and you could see that there was like, you know, it was almost like parallel to the riots in America. The elite Jakarta people, elite Jakartan people were totally sobbing over it. They were crying their hearts out. They were like, why would you burn down the bus station? It's a method of transport for Indonesian people, and it's a method of transport for like Jakartan people, and like isn't this totally against what you wanted? Like you want the workers to prevail, then why would you get rid of this method of transportation that is for the workers? And to that I say bullshit, because it's definitely not for the workers. It is for like elite workers. I would definitely be upset if it was like they burnt down a bus station in, I don't know, like rural Jakarta, where people actually do use to go get to work into Jakarta. But this is for the middle upper class. This is for the 1%, and burning it down is a symbol. And like, as it goes, property can always be replaced, but like, people's lives can't. They will never be replaced. And you know, these laws, they'll endanger us. They'll endanger like the most oppressed minorities, and like specifically when it comes to like it wasn't just like queer people, it was like workers, it was like the working class will be totally like ruined by this. It was like the set of laws that were put out, it was a total capitalist wash. It was from the homosexual like no homosexual law, it was still because like there are definitely homosexual, there are definitely gay people up in the elite, like they will not get these laws at all, because it doesn't affect them. It affects the poor gay people, though. It affects those drag queens that work out late at night, like on the street, singing for money. Like it affects them. It does not affect the gay people people in like parliament, you know, it doesn't affect the people in the ministry. And that's all that is, you know. So when people talk about that, and like when people talk about like if there really is like hope, if there's been a law that's pushed out like that, I truly believe it really only caters to like old Indonesian Muslim men. And okay. I definitely believe that it's something that we can push against with this newer generation that's like totally politically active and totally open and more open-minded whenever they talk. It's honestly amazing. I've seen like talking to even people who go to like national schools, and like this is not something that I would ever talk to with people in national schools, but even people in national schools, they're changing their perspectives toward gay people, and like they're changing their perspectives towards queer people in general. Like, mm-hmm. You know, I would only ever expect acceptance from like an international school, like a kid from an international school. But now it's like, yeah, I can probably be friends with a gay person as long as like they're nice to me, and you know, that requires work, but. Yeah. It's different compared to like 10-20 years ago. It was like I would never be friends with a gay person. Like gay people are weird and they're gonna attack me or something. That
and unfortunately we are getting a bit out of time now, but I think that is such a fantastic note to finish on, to be honest. Mm. Your activism and your passion is so infectious, which I absolutely love about you. But I think that's such a lovely note to end on, the fact that you are so hopeful. And is there anything that you would quickly like to add, Arian?
If you're Indonesian and if you're listening to this, man, kerja keras ya. You gotta work as hard as you can as like an Indonesian person. It's hard, but it's something that we have to do together. And if you're out there and you're not Indonesian listening to this, maybe you could research a little bit about the omnibus law that's happening right now. Maybe you could get a little activism out there yourself as a non-Indonesian person. But yeah.
If you would like to get involved with the work of Report Out, please visit our main website at www.reportout.org, where you can subscribe to our regular email distribution list, which allows you to get exclusive access to our latest and exciting news, blogs, and projects. You can even donate to us to ensure that our work continues. We're also on all social media platforms, so please follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn for regular updates on SOGSC human rights across the globe. Lastly, Report Out would like to give a huge thanks to all of our podcast interviewees and listeners for their valuable time and support. Your voices are no longer hidden, and when voices come together, they make us stronger as a movement.